Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Today we're going to be in, I think, one of the most profound sections of the book of Genesis as it relates to how God deals with men. And God's ways are just not our ways, as Isaiah 55 talks about. It says that after these things, God tested Abraham. Now, the word for God is the term Elohim. It's plural. We're not exactly sure of its origin. In the Genesis, there are two different names, Yahweh and Elohim. Modern critical scholarship has assumed this is two sources. Personally, I agree with the rabbis when they say that Elohim is more God as creator, and Yahweh is God in His mercy, His covenant aspect. I think that's much better, because when you break this up into two sources, you get into all kinds of subjective complications. But it's interesting that God tested. Now, the word here, tested, is not the idea in modern English of to tempt someone to sin. James 2 clearly says God does not tempt anyone to sin. But I think it's equally true that God tests us. God tested Abraham. God's going to test Jesus in Matthew chapter 4. God tested the early church, allowed persecution to come. Testing is not so much for God as it is for us. It seems, beginning back in chapter 12, there had been a series of tests that Abraham has gone through. First of all, in chapter 12, it was leave his home, his relatives, his family, leave his path, his tradition. Then it was to move to Haran. There God confronted Abraham again. And now God's going to confront him in the ultimate test, where it seems like God is going to ask him to give up the very thing that God had been promising him all along, and that was a descendant, and thereby many descendants. Abraham's faith is seen so clearly here, in that when everything is removed from him that he could have trusted in, except God, God showed him the priority that God must be in his life. And I think that's true for us. I think God will test you, my friend, in the area of your priorities and motives. So God tested. Now, this is not unusual. Let me give you several references where it mentions that God tested the nation of Israel or Jacob or on and on. It begins in Exodus 16:4, Exodus 20:20, Deuteronomy 8:2, Deuteronomy 13:3, Judges 2:22, and 2 Chronicles 32:31 are some of the places in the Old Testament where God tests with a view toward approval and strengthening and understanding. Now, God tested Abraham. Now, of course, Abraham changed it from Abram to Abraham. Abraham means the father of a multitude, which, of course, is in line with the covenant promise of 12, 15, 17. But now God's going to ask him to sacrifice the very one that's going to make him the father of multitudes. We see clearly into Abraham's heart, but almost beyond our ability to understand. And he said, Abraham, now the Septuagint doubles this, Abraham, Abraham, but I think they're getting it from later in the narrative where the angel of the Lord stops Abraham in the very act of plunging the dagger into his son. And the double is used there, but the better manuscripts don't have it here, and the Masoretic text doesn't. And he said, here am I, which is kind of a common thing. We've heard Abraham say it before. It's the Hebrew is, I hear, and that it's the idea of I'm listening, I hear you. And God said, take now, listen to this series now. It's a structure to bring the pathos of what God was saying. Now take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Now catch that flow, repetition to bring in the intensity of what he is saying, to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a holocaust, a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will tell you. Now, Moriah. That's a beautiful name, Mount Moriah. There's been a lot of discussion about its particular etymology. The Vulgate and the Samaritan Pentateuch translate it as vision, the word vision. The Targums translate it as the word worship. The Septuagint translates it as the word high. Some very good commentators have said it means, number one, to be shown of Yahweh. Yah will point the mountain out. Or the chosen of Yahweh. Or the place of the appearing of Yahweh. Now, I think this place of appearing probably is what's correct. Because the only place the word Moriah is used is 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1. It's the place where Solomon's temple is going to be located. But it mentions there, it's on the site where God appeared to David. Now, there's two possible references. Some say it goes back to 2 Samuel 24:16. But I really think it goes back to 1 Chronicles 21:18 through 30. Now, Abraham offering Isaac is not mentioned in this context, but I think it was so well known that it was implied. So God had appeared here several times, first to Abraham, then to David, and he's going to appear to Solomon. So it became the place of God's appearing, I think. Now, this burnt offering, there was a ritual procedure for this, and apparently sacrifice had been known long before the days of Moses. We see it first in Cain and Abel. We see it in Noah. We see it in the book of Job, where Job offered sacrifices, and we see Abraham doing it. Not only was he going to have to kill his son, but apparently he was going to have to slit his throat and cut him in half and do something with his entrails. It's a very involved ritual procedure, and then burn his body completely. Oh, my. Oh, my. But look what Abraham does. Abraham does not stagger at that. Abraham doesn't offer any questions that we hear here. Abraham believes that God is going to take care of it. I want to tell you a beautiful commentary on this is Hebrews chapter 11. It says that Abraham was not staggered by God's request, but believed that God would even cause a resurrection from the dead, if necessary, to fulfill his promise. You see, it wasn't the boy, Isaac, it was God himself that was the real source of the promise to Abraham. The focus of Abraham's life was not just a child, but the God that gave him a child. That's true of us. Sometimes we get so caught up in the gifts, we forget the giver is the focus. Now, so Abraham rose early in the morning, no hesitation. Maybe he wanted to get out of the house before Sarah knew about it, because he knew what kind of misery she would cause if she knew what he was going to do. And saddled his donkey and took two of his young men, two of the servants, with him, with Isaac. He split the wood. Now, this may have been Abraham or his servants. I'm not sure which. For the burnt offering, he rose and went to the place of which God had told him. Some commentators say God had shown him in a vision what it looked like. When he got there, he recognized it. Others say God spoke to him later and said, "This is it." We're not sure how. The text just doesn't say. On the third day. Now, he was living in Beersheba, and he's going to go to the area of Jerusalem. Some say that's not 3 days' journey. Well, it's about 20-something hours, 2.5 days' journey by foot. But they got a donkey with them carrying a load of wood, which would make it a little slower than that. So 3 days, I think, is appropriate. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place at a distance. Now, you can't see it too far off, but he saw it at some distance. And he's going to leave the boys there, the two young servants, because they would have not understood what was happening and may have caused trouble. And Abraham said to the young men, "You all stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you." Oh, Abraham's faith is seen here so clearly. I think you ought to, first of all, compare Genesis 21:12, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19, to see the faith of Abraham. Abraham believed that Isaac and himself would return to those two young men after worshiping. He knew he was called to offer his son, but he believed God would work it out. How, he didn't know. Oh, that we could have the kind of faith that not know how God's going to do it or demand God to tell us how to do it, but know that God's going to do it because God is faithful to his promise. That's what he's trying to teach Abraham. The promise is the significance. And the one who makes the promise can be trusted. And oh, Abraham does it here. Oh, my, what an act of faith. Now, notice where it says, Abraham took the wood, I mean, verse 6, of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac. There are many commentators who see a type of Christ in Isaac. And oh, it's just obvious, the connection. He carried the wood. He's going to become a sacrifice. It's striking. Now, the New Testament doesn't make much of that type. I've come to the place, I guess, because I've seen so much abuse in typology and allegory that I'm nervous about being dogmatic about a type that's not specifically mentioned by the New Testament authors. Although I could see how this would be very clear, I personally don't make much of that because it's not alluded to in the New Testament in that way. But I tell you what God would not let Abraham do, God himself did with his own son. Oh my, the depth of the love of God is seen here. The depth of the radical commitment he calls for to man. But friends, I want you to know that maybe there's something of a foreshadowing here of the pathos of God's own heart when he sent Christ into this world to die for sinful men. Notice if you would where it says, "For Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son. He took in his hand the fire and the knife." Now the fire here, it may have been a container to keep the coals from the fire the night before. But it also may have been two flint rocks and some tinder to make a fire. We're not sure how he did that. And the knife, it would be a ritual knife, maybe a flint knife like they circumcised with. Very sharp knife. The Hebrew here is like a butcher knife, something like that. And so the two of them walked together. Boy, Abraham's had 3 days to walk with his son and think about this moment. It was an impulsive act. 3 days. He must not have shared with his son what was happening. And Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And Abraham said, "Here am I, my son." Oh, must have cut like the knife into his heart he was carrying when his boy said that to him. And he said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" It's ironical, isn't it? They knew about offering, knew about sacrifice, wasn't new with Moses. And Abraham said, "The Elohim will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." Now the word "will provide," there's going to be a play on that in verse 14. The word originally meant to see. God will see to it. But it came to be used in the sense that God will provide. And in verse 14, it becomes a name for God. The patriarchs knew God by many names, and most of them were connected to some of the significant acts of God. And this, of course, will be one of them. God will provide for himself. Notice again here is a focus not on human effort, but on God's provision. If anything, these lessons in Genesis taught us is that God takes the initiative, that God provides the resources. Man is asked to respond, but the resources are from God. The love is from God. The provision is from God, not from man. But I tell you what, as God provides, he's asking for quite a response of faith on Abraham's part, isn't he? Friends, he's going to require that kind of faith of you. Becoming a Christian means leaving that which is behind and becoming a brand new person with a brand new focus and brand new priorities. God's showing Abraham what a radical call of fellowship is required. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. Abraham built the altar there. He arranged the wood. He bound his son Isaac. Boy, I want to tell you something of the faith of Isaac here. I don't know how old this boy is. Some commentators say 9, some say 25. We don't know. He's big enough to carry the wood up that hill. Abraham tied him, feet and hands, and Isaac led him. Isaac, not a thing is recorded. Isaac said anything to his father, questioned him. Apparently, it was great faith on the part of this boy of promise, as well as on the patriarch of promise. He bound Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched forth his hands, now probably to slit his throat, because that was the ritual way these animals were killed. You didn't burn somebody alive. You killed them first. And I guess he was going to slit his throat or plunge it in his heart before he had to cut him up to lay him out on the altar. Oh, my. In the middle of that act, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven. I think it's very interesting. I'm going to turn back a few pages or have my notes on this. This idea of the angel of the Lord. I really think it's the pre-incarnate Christ because many times he speaks for God as he will here. Let me give you a few of the references I think are so striking and hope you'll look them up. Look up Genesis 16, 7 through 13. Genesis 18, 1. Genesis 19, 1. Genesis 21, 17 and 19. Genesis 22, 11 through 15. Genesis 31, 13, excuse me, 11 and 13. Genesis 32, 24 and 30. Let's see. Genesis 48, verses 15 and 16. Exodus 3, verses 2 and 4. Exodus 13, verse 21. Exodus 14, verse 19. Judges 6, 12 through 14. Zechariah 3, 1 through 2. 1 and 2. I think these all show that this angel of the Lord many times is a personification of God, that many of us believe is the pre-incarnate Christ, because the angel is going to speak as unto deity. In your notes, I've showed you several other places where the angel of the Lord is not always a personification of God, and sometimes there's a radical distinction here. But here, it's obviously going to speak for God. Abraham, Abraham, he said, "Here am I." And he said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad, and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, the Elohim." Now, fear here is the idea of reverence. Abraham was willing to do whatever God told him. He trusted in God. I wish I knew I had the faith to offer one of my children. You say, "Yeah, but human sacrifice is not God's will." Well, that's true, and we learned that from the Mosaic legislation, but Abraham didn't know that. For there was human sacrifice in Mesopotamia and in Canaan, where he was sojourning. He did not know it was against God at that point. It seemed to be against everything God had promised him. It seemed to be against the character of God. But Abraham trusted God. Friend, do you trust God like that? Do you have a faith that's not conditioned on your pre-understanding or your circumstances or your ability to understand why? Abraham was forced to trust God. Now, "You have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." The thing that God asked Abraham to do and stopped him, God will do himself in Christ. "Then Abraham raised his eyes and behold, and looked, and behold, behind him a ram was caught in the thicket by the horns, and Abraham went and took the ram." Now, you can get so allegorical here. Some say this shows the crown of thorns of Christ. It gets a little wild here. Be careful that you're looking to see what the author understood to be saying and not reading too much of the New Testament into this without New Testament background. The best commentary I've told you is Hebrews 11 and 12. Now, this ram, God didn't say sacrifice the ram, but Abraham does it in thanksgiving to what God has done. Notice he said, "offered him up in the place of his son." This possibly foreshadows the sacrificial system where animals take the place of human being. Now there it's for their sin, or in the sense of fellowship meals. Here it's to offer a sacrifice. "And Abraham called the name of the place, 'The Lord will provide.'" Now that goes back to verse 8. It's really the word "see," but it's the word "will see to it." He will see to it himself. He will take care of it. He will determine the circumstance. He'll provide for himself. He doesn't need me. That's the idea. This is very similar to what the angel of the Lord did to Hagar when he showed her the well, right? Gave her something to drink. Yes, in these times of crisis, God is there. "And it is said to this day," which means we're writing much later than Abraham's day, "in the mouth of the Lord it will be provided." Oh, friends, I don't know how far I can go on this, but I want to tell you what seems to me to be an arrow of red pointing to the death of Jesus Christ. God's going to provide another lamb on this mountain in another day that'll be the substitution for all the sins of the world. Oh, my. Now, in verse 15, "Then the angel of the Lord called Abraham a second time from heaven and said, 'By myself I have sworn, says the Lord.'" Notice the angel speaking. He says, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord." There's obviously the angel is the Lord. The covenant name for God, Yahweh, is used here in verse 16. Now you might want to see Hebrews 6, 13 through 18. The author makes a big deal out of God swore. Now he didn't swear other times, but he swore this time by himself, which is the greatest thing to swear by, that he was going to do something for Abraham. And this is what's mentioned in Hebrews 6, 13 through 18. You ought to read that. Hebrews in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews, is the best commentary I know in a true understanding of the purpose of the Old Testament, along with Galatians 3. Now, "because you have done this thing, have not withheld your son, your only son." Now, God didn't bless Abraham because Abraham did this. God had already counted Abraham righteous, as we saw in the previous lesson back in chapter 15. This is the growth of Abraham's faith, but God is so pleased with his growth. Now, "indeed, I will bless you and I will greatly multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemy. Here's that emphasis again on a mighty nation. Whether it's sand or dust or stars, God's going to provide it. Now, dust has been mentioned back in Genesis 13:16 and in Genesis 28:14. Stars have been mentioned as the metaphor about the multitudinous aspect of its descendants in Genesis 15:5, Genesis 26:4, and sand is also found in Genesis 32:12. Now, so his descendants are going to be made. They're going to possess the gates of their enemy. Now, the idea of the gate of a city was the strong. If you could burn the gate, you could get into the city. So gate became the center of the administrative justice for a city. To control the gate meant to capture something. This same allusion Jesus used in Matthew 16, for the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. Now, here he says that Abraham is going to defeat his enemies in a metaphor that Abraham would have understood. Now, and in your descendants, in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Now, this verse 18 is very interesting. There is a play here in the Hebrew between some of these covenants where the reflexive form is used, which means will bless themselves, and the passive form, which means shall be blessed. Now, this particular account, along with Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, and this account here, it's obviously passive, that they are going to be blessed. The nations are going to be blessed by the seed of Abraham. Now, in Genesis 26:4, it seems to be the reciprocal idea, or excuse me, the reflexive idea of where the nations will bless themselves. Now, what is that saying? God's, and this is what Paul's going to pick up on, the idea of the seed of Abraham being the Messiah. Now, I don't think Abraham understood that, because the word seed can be singular or plural. God seems to be telling Abraham he's going to be the father of many nations. Paul saw in that the promise of the Messiah that would bring all the nations to God. And I think you've got to see the Old Testament. God's dealing with all men in his promises to Abraham, as well as making a unique people for himself. Really, the people he made for himself were to be a kingdom of priests to bring all the world to him. So God chose a man to choose a nation to choose a world. Oh, hallelujah, the universal love of the only God. Now, notice where it says, because you have obeyed my voice. Obedience is crucial. You ought to see Luke 6:46. Now, so Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived there at Beersheba. Now, Beersheba is, of course, south of Jerusalem, and Abraham stayed there a long time. Now, verses 20 through 24 is somewhat unusual, because what we have here is a little biographical situation about Abraham's brother and the kids that he had. It almost seems that someone traveling through the region happened to find Abraham and happened to know his brother Nahor and mentions about the family. Now, the significance in this is that the members of Nahor's family are going to impact Abraham's son Isaac's life. Rebekah is going to be mentioned. Now, it's significant. There are 12 sons of Nahor, and then Abraham's, Isaac and Jacob, and Jacob's going to have 12 sons. It becomes very significant. Now, I think it's unusual. Abraham had been sojourning a long, long time, had not seen his family back in Mesopotamia. He was glad to get the news of him. He now had a son from his wife, and he heard his brother had too. Here's the reference. Now, it came about after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah has also borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz, his firstborn. Now, whether that Uz is related to Uz in the book of Job, we have no way of knowing. And speculation is inappropriate. Firstborn of Buz, his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Aram. Now, don't if you want to look at genealogies, go back to Genesis 10. They're the ones that I think are the best we can do. Sometimes names are the same without referring to the same people, so be careful. And it mentions several more children there in verse 22. And Bethuel. Bethuel means man of God. Obviously a man of great piety and faith like Abraham. There was more men who believed in God than just Abraham in his day. Now, this Bethuel is going to be the father of Rebekah. And, of course, later on, Rebekah is going to be the wife of Isaac. Now, I think it's very interesting that it says there's other passages where it's kind of kind of a mixture about Nahor and Bethuel. You got to remember the word son or relative is very, very general in Hebrew. It can mean son or relative or cousin or great, great, great grandson. And sometimes our Western way of being so precise with our relationship names is so different from the way the Hebrews thought about it. That's why you can't go back and add up all the ages in the Bible of all the sons and fathers and get the date of creation. You can't do that because the fluidity of these Hebrew terms for relatives and relationships. Rebecca. I was interested. I looked at this word in a special dictionary in Hebrew called the BDB, which is Brown Driver and Briggs. It's kind of the Bible of Old Testament words. I was interested. Now, the word Rebecca seems to come from an idea of tying up an animal. And one of the commentators said it means ensnarer. Her beauty was so much that she ensnared men and tied them up. Well, I don't know how much of that we can do, but it's kind of interesting. Better than As the World Turns. And these eight, Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. Now in verse 24, we have something that fits right in the culture, a concubine. And I have mentioned to you that for a long time, scholars said that Abraham's stories, they're just made up. But friends, the more we have archaeological discoveries, the more we find that Abraham and Job fit exactly in the second millennium B.C., particularly with the Nuzi find that showed us the Hurrian culture. And the Caesarian Hittite treaties have really shown us how much Deuteronomy and Abraham's life fit right into the age in which they were written. I think that's so important. So here we have a concubine whose name was Rumah. Now, there's two different words. Some think this means raised. She was raised up from a slave to a concubine. But another derivation of the same word, which is really closer etymologically, is the word for pearl or coral. It means she was kind of a decorated lady. Also born, you have some more Hebrew names there, and these names always kill me same way they kill you. The rabbi, I was going to mention to you, the rabbis say here at verse 24, when Abraham got home from this offering of Isaac, he told Sarah what he had done. And the rabbis say that Sarah cried out loudly seven times and breathed her last and died. Now, I don't know if we can get that from the text, but in chapter 23, we're going to talk about Sarah dying. And the rabbis connect Abraham telling her this story with her having a heart attack and dying. But I think that's a bit fanciful. Well, I think it's a beautiful story. And the last few seconds, I just want to say to you, I hope you'll read back through this. Put yourself in Abraham's shoes. Would you have that kind of faith? I want to tell you it's true that God always comes to us in grace, but He asks for a commensurate response on our part, a response so qualitative and quantitative as to change our entire life, to change our dreams, our plans, our goals, to make Him the sole object of our trust, not our resources or the material world in which we live. I hope God's doing that for you in Jesus Christ. That God's Spirit is turning your heart completely from the things of this world to the things of God. A faith that is not tied to circumstance. Oh, what a God we have. How much He loves us. But He calls on us to love Him. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place next week. God bless you.